Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 43, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And I can't believe that at the time of recording this, we've now just got 8 weeks until Christmas.
Oh, God. Is there anything that you've been thinking about that you want for Christmas, Dan?
Well, you know what? A few of the things we're going to be talking about on this week's show, including, was a pretty big announcement from Nintendo. Their new console got announced in the week.
Oh, yeah.
Might be on my pre-orders list. It's not until March, I don't think, but we'll talk more about that in a bit. And there may be a PlayStation 4 VR set.
Oh.
Which has been a bit of controversy about this week. So we'll talk more about that in the next few minutes. So if you're making your Christmas list, because that clocks go back this weekend.
Oh, God.
Then we're definitely into that time of year, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, sure. An extra hour in bed.
So. That's all nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're going to talk more about this week's hot news stories in just a minute. And if you're new to the show, first of all, where have you been? 43 episodes in. We have a great back catalogue of guests. And this week on the Retro Hour, we're going to be catching up with Raphael Secco.
Yeah, and he's been in kind of companies that we've never mentioned on this, Microgen.
Microgen, yeah, of course, back in the day.
And he stopped with the Videomaster Superscope. I've never even heard of that.
That was his first console, wasn't it?
yeah. But then he worked with Hoosen. Yeah. We had Rob Hoosen on the other day. And Mev Dink as well, from Vivid Image. So this is a great connecting guest here.
Absolutely. And also, you know, Legendary Games has worked on Exelon, Cybernoid, Stormlord. He had a column in Crash Magazine, the biggest Sinclair Spectrum mag back in the day.
We're having a bit of a Spectrum vibe at the moment, aren't we, Dan?
And also, he used to sneak boobies into his video games.
Oh, naughty things in the games. Right.
So we're going to catch up with Raphael Secco on the Retro Hour in the next half an hour. Now, every week on the show, we always give a massive big up to our various generous donators who've contributed to the running costs of the Retro Hour.
Yeah, they've just gone on theretrohour.com and click donate.
And this week, got to say a massive thank you to Stephen Marshall.
Colin Reed.
And Sarin Lagard, who've all made very generous donations to the podcast. Thank you so much, guys. That's really, really appreciated. And of course, if you ever want to leave a little tip, theretrohour.com.
And thank you for your iTunes reviews as well. We've posted some really nice ones that we've had on Facebook. And, you know, this kind of stuff makes it worth it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just doing this, and sometimes it's a stress getting guests and sometimes it's hard to get in. But you know what? It's all worth it when you post really amazing stuff like that. Thanks, guys.
And Ravi gets in hot water off his girlfriend for, you know, leaving her to come in the studio.
Yep.
It's a welcome break, isn't it?
Yeah.
You could be out doing worse things. Come on.
Yeah.
So let's get into this week's stories then. Now, we did mention, of course, I know it's not technically retro, but they are the oldest video games company in the world, so everyone's
and direction into the retro compared to the other ones, I think, with the design of it.
We are talking about the Nintendo Switch, Nintendo's newest console. What are your thoughts then? What do you think?
I think that in a few years, CEX is going to be full of broken bits of Nintendo Switches, all the different elements. There's a lot of bits that can break on there, but hopefully their build quality will be high. I think with the third-party support as well, that they've released a list of all the companies they've got on there. Mm-hmm. They haven't had this many third-party companies since the GameCube. You know, this is big.
It is. I mean, the trailer came out earlier on this week, and apparently, is it Tegra 4 chips that I think it's based on?
I think so, yeah.
So I think, power, you know, in terms of raw power, they reckon it's not even going to be as powerful as an Xbox One or a PS4 currently. But again, you know, for Nintendo consoles, they don't really go for that kind of raw power kind of thing, do they? It's more the experience and their... I mean, you know, really, at the moment, you buy a Nintendo console for their first-party releases, don't you? And looking at that trailer, I'll tell you what I thought was really cool about it. I saw a little bit of a change in direction. Did you notice watching it that everyone in that was like in the 20s and 30s?
Oh, yeah. Young and cool and hip.
But usually there's like little toddlers in their adverts. Now they're going for people in, like, you know, who've got jobs, who are older, a more like mature audience.
Well, if you think about it, the market that has took all of Nintendo's casual gamers has been the tablet or the mobile market. This looks like a tablet and it supports that stuff. So games like Fruit Ninja and all of this kind of stuff, I can imagine, are going to come on this and all these big Android titles, and that's just going to boost the Nintendo, because before it was a choice like, oh, do I get a DS and stick in the Nintendo universe, or do I get an Android phone and get all of them, you know? And so hopefully now you'll have all these casual games in one kind of nice device.
I've heard that you probably can get that as well. I mean, you know, there are rumours that maybe some kind of Android stuff will be on there as well. But also what I think, you know, the fact you look at the games they were playing on the trailer they put out, and it was like NBA and Skyrim was in there as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't all your Angry Birds and all that kind of thing. So it seems like they're actually kind of returning a bit to kind of appealing to like proper gamers, not, you know, before the Wii was for like grandma and like 6-year-old Billy,
yeah, that's what I mean about the GameCube as well, because the GameCube had some, you know, serious games in there.
It looked like a kid's toy, but...
yeah, it looked totally like a kid's toy, but this also looks totally like a kid's toy, to be honest.
I mean, it kind of...
with those things that you stick on the side, it does look... It's not like your sensible, sexy tablet. It's like a bit of a chunky Nintendo item, but...
It looks a bit weird, I think. You know, you look in the trailer and, like, it. You know, if you haven't watched it, it is basically like a tablet that you can pull the sides of the controller off and you can flip them around and two people can actually play in one console using each, like, one person's got the D-pad and one's got the analog stick.
Yeah, it's strange. I'm just wondering as well, is it touchscreen or not? Are they just going to totally use it as a display surface?
I think it is touchscreen. I think it's actually, you know, better than the Wii U one that wasn't, you know, you couldn't do the multi-touch and all that on the Wii U, but I think on this one you can from what I've seen. But there were actually, you know, I mentioned NBA and Skyrim there. This was actually a bit naughty of Nintendo because a couple of days later, Bethesda, for example, released a statement saying, oh, we haven't actually confirmed Skyrim for it. We just worked with Nintendo on the trailer.
So a lot
of the games they were showing in the trailer are not actually confirmed for it.
I thought you meant Nintendo had just ported it. Who cares? But yeah.
No, it was more like they said, we were happy to work with Nintendo on the trailer, but at this time we've got no plans to develop anything for it. So a few companies have said that who appeared in the trailer, which, you know, is a bit misleading.
Because we heard ages ago that all the dev kits had been sent out to all the companies for the new NX. So, yeah. You know, they'd obviously been hitting the right targets, but we'll see you. What comes out of this? But do you think it's going to save them in the console sense?
See, a lot of people have been saying, haven't they, it's great they've got third-party companies back. But, you know, you remember the start of the Wii U. That had, like, Call of Duty and FIFA and all that was on it when it first came out, but then they dropped off. What I think a lot of people are doing is, I think a lot of developers are kind of, you know, going to sit back and watch how the first kind of 6 months do.
Well, they're kind of doing a two-pronged attack, aren't they? They're going with the new retro mini console that's going to, you know, take all the casual gamers. And then they're going to have the, like, older, modern ones with this new Switch. Yeah. It's going to be interesting.
And, I mean, you know, I'm not exactly sure. I haven't read if they're going to be discontinuing the 3DS.
I don't know.
I know the Wii U's dead. That's going to be gone.
Yeah.
But whether they're going to try and just have this one system that will replace, you know, the 3DS and the Wii U. What they really need is that 3DS market to start buying Switches, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's where they succeed.
That's it. And just transfer everybody onto that. But we'll see what happens. It's a... very brave move, I think.
Should I tell you what I loved in the trailer, though?
What?
Did you see the clip of the new Mario game in there?
No.
They showed about 2 seconds of it, but it basically looked like Mario 64 upgraded to like full HD.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't like
I guess potential with emulators on this would be amazing as well. But we could talk about this all night, and I guess you're probably sick of all the other podcasts talking about it as well. So.
But I will just say, I'm going to get one as soon as it comes out.
Yeah, sure, and I'll be round to break it when I'm drunk.
Right, let's get in some proper retro news, shall we?
Yep.
Okay, then. So this is getting HDMI on your Sinclair Spectrum using a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, and this has been submitted by Starquake, one of our listeners. He sends us great news. And this is insane, actually. It's called TK Pi.
Okay.
And it's an interface that does HDMI video. Now, what you can do is you can plug a Raspberry Pi Zero, which I don't know if you know, they're those ones that cost about £8.
Really cheap, aren't they? Single little board computer.
Incredibly cheap. And then you just stick it in the back of your Spectrum. And it's all open source. And all the software is, you know, fully available. And this works with the Spectrum Next, works with the older Spectrums as well.
Oh, cool. In the expansion port.
Yeah.
So basically you can have you use the HDMI output of the Raspberry Pi to show your Spectrum's video output on a modern TV.
I'm thinking, why don't they do this with other consoles? Because this is a really smart idea, just using the Raspberry Pi to do its own thing.
Because they're so cheap now.
And then, kind of making an interface with it.
I mean, you look at, like, you know, the Amiga, for example, like the Indivision things, they cost, like, what, 130 quid?
Yeah, I can imagine it's the same for the Atari and probably the Acorn and stuff. Imagine if you could get that and just stick this board in with a Raspberry Pi on and go mad.
Well, I mean, looking at it, I mean, I must admit, my home electronic skills are not all as hot as they probably used to be when I was at school and used to build, like, you know, radios and that kind of thing. But it doesn't look that complex, really. And there is, it's all on GitHub here, the complete instructions and what you need to order and how to build it and everything. And I guess, you know, as long as you don't blow your Spectrum up, Raspberry Pi is pretty disposable. You can always get a new one.
Yeah, £8. Who cares?
Yeah. So I think that's awesome, though. So if you want to find out a bit more about that, we'll pop that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we often cover these kind of like, you know, new retro systems, you could say. This one looks pretty cool, though. The Retro Freak.
Yes, we mentioned the Retro Freak before, but it wasn't actually out. Now it's out, but only in Japan for some reason. We'll hope that it gets a further release everywhere else. But it's amazing what this can do. It can do 11 systems.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's got cartridge slots for like everything on it, by the looks of it.
11 systems, and you can rip the carts as well. So you can rip the carts onto kind of a hard disk. But the main thing about what they're actually saying is the Retro Freak itself is not the console.
Right.
So the Retro Freak is this cartridge that you put inside the console.
How's that work then?
So the console simply acts as a cartridge reader.
Right.
It's just one big fat cartridge reader to read 11. The Retro Freak is a tiny little cartridge that you have that you can plug into your TV. You can plug your controllers in and just do HDMI out of that. So it's this little cartridge. That's the actual brains of the operation.
I guess it's all just housed on one chip then, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the rest of it's dumb. You know, it's just a dumb unit that receives cartridges.
And then just rips them when you put them in.
Yeah. But it means you can basically get all your old school games ripped onto this thing, pick it in your pocket, put it in your pocket, go around your mate's house, you know, hook it up to his TV, and it's the size of a SNES cartridge.
Yeah. I bought 11 systems with me. What? But I mean, there are other ones like the Retron 5, for example, but this looks a lot smaller and a lot more compact. And it's even got, I think it's like USB on the front there, but they are saying there are adapters to plug your original controllers in, or you can use an Xbox controller, for example.
Yeah. And it's, you know, no pirating as well, because what you're actually doing is you're ripping off the game.
Mm-hmm. Off the cartridge.
Off the cartridge, yeah. So, you know, it's a legal way to obtain games and you can walk around with them. It's amazing.
Although it does say here on geek.com that, you know, you can actually just download stuff and put it on a micro SD card, you know. Not that we recommend that or anything, but you know, I'm sure it is possible.
Yeah, there is a slot there.
But it looks pretty cheap as well. I mean, you know, the guy wrote this article for geek.com. He said it was $150 he bought it. You have to, you know, got it when he was out in Japan, but there are websites that will import it to all around the world.
The question is as well, the compatibility. Let's hope this is a bit more compatible than the Retron.
Yeah, because I know some people reported glitches and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there was a few issues. And with 11 systems, man, that's going to be...
It's a lot of testing, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, if you are thinking of Christmas present ideas, that might be a nice little stocking filler this year. Now, obviously, Team 17 are one of our favourite companies, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Love them.
Super Stardust, do you remember that game?
Oh, yeah, I got a copy for my CD32, and I managed to get it for 30 quid.
Okay, that's not bad.
People are putting them on eBay, 150.
But it was kind of like, it was just an upgraded Asteroids game, really, wasn't it?
It was, but then there was tunneled sections. This is the thing. This is the most annoying thing about Super Stardust, that they basically had the best sections. You had to get through about 6 levels to get to it,
yeah,
and it lasted 10 minutes. And the rest of it was just Asteroids clone, you know?
Well, Ravi, you're in luck.
Ooh.
Because Super Stardust has been ported to the Commodore 64. But nice. By the looks of it, only the tunnel sections.
Yes! Excellent. Those are the most impressive ones. What, on the C64?
Yeah, so there's actually just a demo of it running at the moment. And it looks pretty cool. The scrolling and all that kind of stuff set. Obviously, you know, there's not as many colours as on, you know, an AGA chipset Amiga, for example. And they're saying it does actually need a bit more RAM than the normal Commodore 64 comes with. So you need like a RAM pack or... playing an emulator, for example.
Super C64. Yeah. I don't know, something, yeah.
Super Stardust for the Super C64, yeah. But at the moment, there is like a little demo that you can download to try it out. And apparently, it's, you know, this section of it is up and running pretty nicely.
Well, that tunnel section really reminds me of Wipeout.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
absolutely. That's like a really early version of Wipeout for me.
It's Wipeout was about 2 years after that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it's cool that, you know, we have kind of covered a few of these... ports of more advanced games onto the 8-bit systems recently, but it's been a lot of Spectrum ones recently, but it's nice to see a bit of Commodore love in there as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Obviously, a few months ago on the Retro Hour, back at the start of the summer, we were talking about the BBC Micro, the Micro Bit, that mini little ARM-based machine that the BBC had released.
Yeah, I think it was about £4 as well, each machine. Well, it's been massively successful in the UK. And, you know, they're saying here they've had 13 million... visitors to the BBC resource site. So that's basically 13 people actively going on the site, looking at stuff, developing programs. You know, they've had 10 million that have created programs in the emulator or the kind of scratch thing online.
Okay.
Which is amazing. And they're saying that the effect on GILs as well is massive. Early research shows that 39% of guilds that have used the micro bit said they'd definitely prefer it than IT or computer science at school, because it's a lot more interesting using a computer and
that's pretty
coding
cool, right?
It, yeah.
It's, you know, I love the whole concept of the fact that there's a new BBC Micro is just awesome. And, you know, again, it's doing what it did back in the 80s. It's this kind of project to get kids interested in coding and making software. And
yeah, and how stuff works, you know, kind of learning how things work. And the people involved are, you know, Arm, Microsoft, yeah. Nominet, Samsung, BBC, all these massive companies. So this is going to go global now after its UK success. So hopefully Microbits will start going into Iceland, Singapore, Norway, US cities.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Because, I mean, obviously the Raspberry Pi's out there, but again, I mean, I heard the BBC, they were giving these out to schools, weren't they, for free?
Yeah, yeah. And this is kind of, it's not like a Pi where you can just load Kodi and watch loads of movies on it. It's more of a kind
of... I'm sure someone will find a way.
Yeah, it's more kind of a coding machine with Python and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, so it's cool that more people are going to get their hands on it. I mean, I haven't got one yet, so...
No, I haven't. We need to go and rob a school or something.
I could just order off the website.
Yeah, that would make more sense.
You can take the boy out of Nottingham.
And probably get the old BBC micros.
Now, I did talk about this little bit of scandal that's been doing the rounds with... game during the week in the PlayStation VR. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I saw a little article posted. Yeah.
So this is obviously the new PlayStation VR has come out. And a lot of people, you know, it's going to be the hot seller this Christmas, isn't it? Apparently, if you go into game and you want to try it out for half an hour, it'll cost you 15 quid.
15 quid?
Yep.
For half an hour? That's bloody disgrace, because I was at Alt Video Game Lounge in Nottingham and they've got HTC Vive, which is a lot nicer. And that would be like 5 quid for 45 minutes, yeah, or something. Like,
and bear in mind that, you know, game are not an arcade. They're a shop trying to sell you this thing.
Yeah, to sell you the product. Yeah. That's so bad.
I know.
And, you know, I think so many people have had bad experiences with VR. You know, they've used kind of Google Cardboard or like much lesser versions of VR. Oh, this is amazing. But it's nothing compared to like the HTC Vive. I've had a lot of my friends actually say, oh, VR's rubbish. And I said, have you tried it?
Yeah.
No.
Again, though, you think game, I mean, you know, they haven't had a lot of success in terms of, you know, their finances. They went bankrupt about 2 years ago, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And you think this Christmas is really make or break for VR, I think, isn't it? The need to get people in, you'd be dragging them off the street, try this out. Because a mate of mine made a point on my Facebook. He said, well, you know, it's half term at the moment, going to get a load of snotty kids in and won't be buying it. But those kids will be making their Christmas lists and it'll be like, Mummy and Daddy, I want a PlayStation VR.
Yeah, they're not pushing it, man. And like, if this was out in the 90s, you're right, you'd have units in the street, you'd have guys dragging people out. And this is, you know, the kind of future path that PlayStation set themselves on with the PlayStation Pro coming out and stuff.
And it's like, you know, putting up a barrier, 15 quid to try it out. It's like...
And that's your main game retailer, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the UK, you know?
Yeah, it's nuts. And it'd be like walking into Curry's and being like, you know, I want to watch, see what that new 4K TV looks like. All right, yeah, 50 quid before you can turn it on. You know what I mean? It's like, you're trying to sell me this thing here. But you made an interesting point there. I mean, I've been into a few of the game stores around here recently. And even on a Saturday, there's like, what, four people in?
Yeah, totally. They're just completely dead. And I even remember when it was Electronics Boutique.
I remember Future Zone before that.
Future Zone, yeah. Yeah.
Did that call Robot Head, do you remember?
Yeah, logo? Yeah. I think more people actually buy their games from like secondhand shops and online as well.
Supermarkets.
Yeah, supermarket. Yeah. Asda. The queue at Asda for GTA 5 was massive.
But, you know, I remember going into like Future Zone. And as a kid, and on a Saturday, me and my mates, we'd go in like, you know, little shops in town. We'd always end up in there, Electronics Boutique after. And it'd just be full of kids like playing on Mega Drives and PlayStations. And it'd be like a place to go. And obviously, I mean, there is an argument that you don't want, you know, keep seeing people say you don't want snotty kids who are going to break all the stuff. But those are the kids that will be nagging their parents to buy this kind of stuff. And it was just like a go-to place back then. We used to all love hanging out
there.
It's
really strange because I think, you know, they can get hype so wrong on certain things, like, you know, I've wanted this since I was a kid.
Yeah,
VR. And seriously, when I went on the HTC Vive, that was like the first time I truly experienced it, and you know, it felt like decent VR. The Oculus dev unit. The first one was like...
Ugh. We tried that in was Manchester, and the Wolverhampton, wasn't it? Yeah, a replay a couple of years back, yeah. And that was like the version one, wasn't it, of that? But again, it's like, I'm not sure that VR is going to take off again. I'm feeling very sceptical now, the more I see it.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to try this PlayStation one, but I'm not going to pay 15 quid.
Don't buy it from Game. Yeah. So we'll keep an eye on it, though. Interesting. Now, if you're listening at work maybe at the moment, I know we do get a lot of listeners who tweet us actually during the week, and you know, I got my earphones in at my desk at work. Maybe you want to play Pac-Man or Breakout in the office.
Yeah, well, it might be blocked. Certain gaming sites might be blocked. But what you can do is you can go onto Google Images. Do you want to do it now, Dan?
This is real, is it? So, yeah, so what do I do then? I go to Google.com.
Google.com, okay. Click Images, and type in the word Atari Breakout.
So it's in the Images tab, yeah? Atari, okay. It's a top result, actually, for when you start typing it. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so what it does is it takes all the images and turns...
Oh, it's got sound as well.
Yeah.
Listen to that.
Yeah, make sure your speakers are turned down at work.
Yeah, that'll give it away, won't it? Yeah. It's a very noisy Excel spreadsheet you've got there, Clive. So it turns all the images into a game of Breakout.
Yeah, so into like Breakout blocks, and you can literally play with the Breakout images. There's all kinds of cool little things, and we've got a link here on the Mirror that's talking about them. And you know, did you know in Facebook you can play a game of chess or basketball against each other on the instant messenger?
Hey, you just continue doing the show. I'm playing Breakout.
Yeah.
That's awesome, though. I love little Easter eggs in like commercial websites and stuff that you don't find out about. I wonder how long that's been in there.
Yeah, you know, and they've compiled a little list of them as well. There's, you know, the Pac-Man one, which they had on the Google Doodle.
Yeah.
If you type Pac-Man into Google, you'll get it in the top right corner as well. So there's all these cool little kind of things.
And you can't get fired for looking at Google.
No, you can't. There you go. It's not blocked, is it?
Now, before we get into this week's interview with Raphael Secco, a bit of cool Apple news. Now, do you remember the Apple II GS?
GS, was that the kind of big desktop version?
Yeah, it was the one that came out in 1986, I think this came out. It was kind of one of the later original, you know, Apple products that came out.
Pre-Mac.
Yeah, well, Mac was out by then, actually.
Okay.
This was kind of, you know, the Apple II.
So this is when they had the two camps going, the Macintosh and the Apple II. Okay.
And this is kind of the swan song for the Apple II, if I remember correctly. But, you know, Woz was still at Apple and all that then, Steve Wozniak.
Yeah.
And there was... no pun intended, some limited edition Apple II GSs with Steve Wozniak's signature on them.
Oh, nice. Because I guess the Apple II camp must have been big Woz fans as well.
Yeah, well, it was really like Apple's first big machine, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's where all the Apple fanboys, you know, originated from. And it turns out, anyway, there's this guy who posts on a forum here, you know, neowin.net, he posts on there. And he's looking through his basement, and you remember that he had an Apple II GS that his mum bought him, like, buried down there, you know, when it first came out. And what it turns out is he'd read online that there are some limited edition Woz systems, and he thought, I wonder if mine is. So he went and looked down there, and it turns out that he had Steve Wozniak's signature on this machine.
Oh, my God. How could you forget about that in your basement?
It's like, right on the front of it as well. And only the first 50,000 of them that ever got released are these limited edition Wozniak editions of the Apple II GS. So, there are a couple of them out there, apparently.
Oh, that sounds great, because, you know, you hear about Steve Jobs a lot of the time, and you don't hear about the engineer behind it all, who was Woz. And he's actually a real, genuinely nice guy. Like, when he left Apple, he went to teach kids how to, you know, create computers. And he's just amazing. Right? We love Woz.
I think with Woz as well, he's a proper computer geek, isn't he? He's never a businessman. He never, you know, obviously Steve was kind of that side of it. We must make more money, you know, a lot of it was about that. But Woz, like you said, he was just like, he did it more as a mission to get this stuff out of the world, didn't he, I think?
Yeah, totally. And he's just a nerd in love of the tech.
Yeah. And these early systems as well, I mean, you know, we mentioned there's 50,000 of them. They made 1.2 million of these Apple II GSs. Sounds like a lot of them, but then you think this was like 30 years ago. I imagine a lot of them have gone in the bin or the skip or, you know, whatever. So quite how many's out there. Apparently they are pretty rare these days. So especially if you've got like an early serial number.
Yeah, so if your mum bought you a computer back in the days, check the basement.
Absolutely. So thank you for checking out episode number 43 of the Retro Hour podcast. We'll be out again next Friday, available from SoundCloud, Stitcher, if no one's DDoSing it this week.
Yeah, God, sorry about that last week.
Yeah, and half the internet was down on Friday last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it managed to come out like half an hour later. Yeah. Anyway.
I got a bit of a panic on, but we got there eventually.
Yeah, and check out our Facebook as well, because I'll be DJing at Game City. We're actually recording this today before I'm DJing, but there should be video online if my laptop hasn't blown up.
Oh, your Amigas won't blow up, it'll be the laptop.
Oh, yeah, that's it, the Windows one.
Ravi DJing on Amiga 1200. They get on so well when we put them on Facebook, so definitely worth a look. Just search for the Retro Hour podcast. We'll see you again next Friday, and now into this week's special guest for the next half an hour, taking you back to the Spectrum days, Houston Consultants, Exelon, Cyberloid, Stormlord, Street Racer, Crash Magazine.
Last Samurai, Amiga.
Oh, there's so much this week. Rafael Secco is a lovely guy, and he's on the Retro Hour for the next half an hour. And we'll see you next week.
Ciao.
First of all, Raf, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast this week.
No problem at all. It's a pleasure.
Now, we're going to get into your history and some of the amazing games that you've worked on over the years. First of all, though, let's go right back to the start. Where did it all begin, then? What was your first computer experience?
Well, it was... In those days, people used to rent television sets. I don't know if you remember people doing that from places like Radio Rentals, but my dad came home one day with a new TV, which we'd rented, and they'd bundled with it. It was called a VideoMaster Superscore, which was basically like a Pong variant where you could play football and very simple games like that. And it kind of developed from there. So I eventually took this thing apart, as kids do, and saw the microchips inside. I thought, you know, what the hell are these black things with legs? What do they do? And my interest grew from that. And we eventually got an Atari VCS, a ColecoVision, a Mattel Intellivision. We had everything at home. We had, you know, all the consoles over the years. And eventually I got my first computer, which was a ZX81. I learned how to program in BASIC on that, and that kind of developed into the Spectrum, which I got hold of a bit later. And that's when things really took off. I taught myself how to program properly in machine code and so on. And it all started from that.
I'm glad it wasn't just me that was that kid that used to take everything to bits. I did, like, the video recorder came to bits. And...
No, I used to dismantle absolutely everything, toys and everything. And it's really annoying now when I see, you know, things like... I don't know, the Corgi James Bond card worth quite a bit of money now. Might just smash to smithereens somewhere, you know.
Yeah, so what were your kind of favourite arcade games then on your Super Score?
Well, the only thing that was on that was Pong and variations of Pong, really. There wasn't really much going on the VideoMaster Super Score, but certainly at school I was playing a lot of games in the arcades. At lunchtime and sometimes not at lunchtime, you know, Phoenix, Defender, Galaxian, all those kind of classic arcade games.
Yeah, Phoenix was brilliant. I think very underrated Phoenix, but a lot of people kind of mention it, you know, that we talk to in their memories.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that you don't see mentioned that often, but I really enjoyed it. I just all the birds that were flying around and the big mothership at the end. It was a really nice, colourful game. I really enjoyed playing that one.
I think it was kind of the first time I'd ever seen like an end boss in a game as well.
Yeah, well, in a way it was really, wasn't it? Yeah, and it was actually a fairly elaborate end boss for such an early game. It was quite unusual in that respect, certainly.
So how did you get into coding and making your own games then? How did that develop?
Well, that was mostly playing around on the Spectrum where I taught myself machine code. And I was doing my A-levels at the time, but I was just fed up with school, and I wanted to leave, basically. And I thought, well, the only way I can have an excuse for leaving is to actually find a job. So I sent off some demos, you know, just some sprites flying around and things like that I'd been working on. Sent them off to a few companies, and I got a reply back from Microgen, who did all the Wally games, Pyjama-Rama and so on. And they thought I was good enough for them to give me a job on 4,250 quid a year, from what I remember. It wasn't very much money, but I was thrilled to be working in the games industry.
I think this is the first time we've heard Microgem mentioned on this podcast. Were they kind of a big company at the time? Or?
No, not really. There was only about three or four of them when I in the programming section anyway. And they were based up above a news agent somewhere in Surrey. And, yeah, it was a very small company. They also had a shop that sold computer games as well. But the programming side was really quite small. But they had a very, very good team. The guys that were there were really, very good.
And were they mainly releasing for the Spectrum?
Yeah, it was for the Spectrum. And later on, they did the Amstrad versions as well. and the Commodore 64, of course.
Well, you mentioned you started working there when you were still doing your A-levels. I mean, was that kind of a difficult decision? Were your parents supportive of your choice?
Yeah, well, they were happy that I'd found something that I wanted to do, and you know, I'd been offered a job. You know, bearing in mind I was only 17 at the time, so it kind of beat working in the supermarket or my dad's calf. So it was a bit of a no-brainer, really. I accepted it, and they were quite happy to see me do it, really.
You know, in that era, though, I mean, was working in the video games industry, was that kind of seen as a proper job, or did not many people understand it then?
No, it wasn't seen as a proper job at all. I mean, I remember meeting up with some friends and family, and someone asked me, you know, what do I do for a living? And I said, well, I create video games. And they said, is that legal? I don't think they had any idea. I don't know what they think I was actually doing, but no, there was a lot of ignorance in those days. They had no real idea what was involved or where these things came from at all.
They'd been watching War Games or something, probably.
I think it was all based around that sort of thing, and, you know, people playing video games and becoming violent and all this kind of stuff.
And I guess there was not that much money going around in that industry at that time.
No, certainly not going into my pocket, that's for sure. Some people were making money at the time, but it wasn't me. As I said, my first job was 4,250 quid a year at Microgen, which is, you know, kind of laughable now, but I was quite happy to work for that at the time.
Well, the first title you worked on there was Equinox.
That's correct.
What memories have you got of working on that game then?
That was an interesting time, actually, because before that I'd never actually put together a complete game. It had only been little demos and things, and, you know, there's a huge difference between putting together a demo and actually seeing the game to the bitter end. So I learned a lot. So, you know, I got a lot of help while I was at Microgen as well, and all credit to the guys that were there. But, it was quite an experience actually having to finish a product and get it out to the market. As you know, there was a lot of things going on to actually get to that stage.
So had you kind of completed it to a point and then someone says, this isn't good enough, or was it finished when you finished it?
There was an expectation that you would finish it within, I don't know, 6 to 9 months or something like that. So you couldn't go beyond that, otherwise people would start asking questions. So you kind of had to knuckle down and get the thing finished. And it was all nicely, you know, it was a very simple game, so it didn't take ages to plan out or anything. We had all the levels drawn out on paper and so on, and just went ahead and finished it.
As you know, someone who was like, you know, what, were you still 17 years old when that came out then, were you?
Yeah, I was around 17, 18 at that time.
Do you remember the first time you saw your game in a shop then? That must have been quite an experience.
It was, yeah, and seeing, you know, the box with all the nice artwork and my name at the back, it was a very nice thing to see, actually. You know, you think, well, you know, this is, now I can show someone that, you know, I'm not a bank robber or whatever it is they think I'm doing, and show them the box and say, well, this is what I do, is have, you know, something tangible in your hands.
Did you ever try and convince anyone in the store to buy the game?
Sorry?
Did you ever try to convince anybody in the shop, you know, buy this game, it's great?
No, it sold pretty well, actually, so I didn't actually have to do that.
Well, I know that game did get a really good reception, and I mean, obviously around this time, kind of you lived and died by the magazine reviews, really, didn't you? I mean,
everything was based around what the magazines were going to write. I mean, they were hugely important in those days. Obviously, there was no internet, so that's where people made their buying decisions.
What was it like waiting for the magazine reviews then? That must have been quite a nervous time.
It was. I mean, your heart would be thumping when you walked into the newsagents and picked up the magazine. You knew that the review was in there, and you quickly flipped through to the page and you thought, oh, thank God, it's a good review. You know, it was, it was crucially important and quite nerve-wracking.
Kind of like a theatre performance at the end where they're like, the reviews are in. You know, it must have been like
that. Exactly the same. I can only imagine it's exactly the same as that, yes.
Just looking straight for that score at the end first.
You skip through everything and go straight for the score.
Well, did you have any involvement in, obviously, the ill-fated Micro Plus project?
Yeah, I mean, that's what eventually caused Microgen to close down, because they invested a lot, well, I'd say a lot of money, but it was about 150,000, I think, they'd invested, which, you know, then was quite a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that was to produce, like, a cartridge that plugged into the back of the Spectrum, which had the joystick ports and some additional memory. So the idea was that you could have a bigger, better game in there with an extra 16K or something. Unfortunately, the game that they decided to put in it first was rubbish, basically. And it just all went downhill from there. It was full of bugs and it just didn't work out. It was a big mistake, really. They should have just carried on doing normal Spectrum games, which they were very good at.
So that was kind of a thing. I know around the time, obviously, Imagine Software, they had kind of their super games that were meant to come out that needed, like, more resources and that. I mean, was it kind of a thought that the Spectrum needed, like, more RAM to do these bigger games?
Well, the funny thing was we were also working on another game at the time called 3 Weeks in Paradise, which was another Wally game, and it was based in the jungle or something. And that was also on the Micro Plus with the extra 16K of memory. Then when we discovered we couldn't actually release the game on the Micro Plus because they weren't going to produce it, it was actually quite easy to reduce it down so it fit in the normal Spectrum anyway. So it had been a bit of a waste of time. People just got very kind of laissez-faire with all the memory and everything when they had extra memory to play with. And they just wasted it, basically. It wasn't actually needed.
Sounded like they were incredibly bloated. That's why they needed to fit on the...
it just didn't work. It wasn't necessary. We should have just focused on doing normal games. And we proved, you know, when I joined Houston later on, it was quite possible to produce great games without the extra memory. So,
well, the timing of this is great as well, because last week we just had Rob Hewson on telling us about how they're kind of coming back. And you joined Hewson after Microgem went into financial difficulty.
That's right, yes, I did.
How was it?
Was great. Hewson, they were a really good company. They were a small company, but the people that were there were, you know, they all knew their stuff. Andrew and the other coders they had there, even, you know, everyone in the marketing department, they're all really good people, good laugh, and I had a great time when I was there. Certainly a better time than I had at Microgem, that's for sure.
How did you get the job there? Did you send any tapes in? Or?
No, it was it was a very small industry then. So when you were looking for work or publishers were looking for developers, it didn't take long to actually meet up. And I just went there with it might have been with a demo of Exelon, possibly, I think, and showed that to Andrew Hewson. He loved it, and we agreed to work together.
Well, Exelon was the first game that you worked on that Hewson released. I remember that it did get a lot of fanfare at the time as well. I've even read that people referred to you as like the saviour of the home computer scene at the time that game came out. I mean,
I'm very flattered they say that. But it had nice graphics and it looked very arcadey. So it kind of maybe breathed a bit more life into the Spectrum, and I carried that on with Cybernoid as well.
And that got some really good reviews as well. I mean, that must have helped kind of really put your name on the map when that game got so big.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I was a very well-known Spectrum programmer. I think I got recognised in the street once. So there you go. That was my claim to fame. There you go.
Well, speaking of things that helped raise your profile, I mean, you had a regular column in Crash magazine as well. Tell us a story about that then. How did that start?
Well, that was actually Andrew Hewson's idea to do this a monthly diary, which was 2 or 3 pages every month in just about the biggest magazine at the time. And to be quite honest, I wasn't keen on the idea because I was working on the game. I thought, well, this is another thing that I have to do now every month on top of all the graphics and the programming. But I could see it was a really good opportunity to get a huge amount of publicity for free, effectively, in a very popular magazine, so I kind of went with it. And, it just carried on from there. So every month I had to think up some, you know, unique and funny and interesting stories about video games development, which is actually quite boring a lot of the time from a technical point of view. So I just tended to write about the people that I dealt with and the relationships and all that kind of thing, which made it a bit more interesting.
I guess at that time period as well, as you said, the Spectrum was kind of reaching the end of its life and you gave it a new gust of wind or a new bit of fresh air. I guess Crash was also doing that, keeping that community alive.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it was a great magazine. I mean, you flick through it and it was just all colours and big pictures and all that. It was a lovely thing to look at, Crash, as well. And I think, it really retained the interest in the Spectrum, possibly longer than it deserved from a technical point of view anyway. So, it was a very nice thing to be able to do.
Do you have maybe one story or one column that, you know, particularly sticks in your mind from those that used to write for Crash?
There was once when I went, I think they were based in Ludlow, I think it was. I went down to see them, and the journalist there thought it would be a great idea if I stood on this very high wall that happened to be there and jumped off, and they take a picture of me in midair or something. I don't remember why we wanted to do this, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. I remember thinking it was a bit high, but I still did it anyway, and I ended up on my backside on the floor. Thankfully, they didn't get any pictures of that, but it did hurt quite a bit, actually. Apart from that, it was, every month it was just conversations with Andrew Hewson and things that happened, and that kept it relatively entertaining.
Well, I imagine working at Hewson back at kind of their heyday at that time, what was kind of the atmosphere like of working there? Were you there day to day, or did you kind of come and go?
No, I used to go about maybe once or twice a month because I was actually working freelance, about 40 miles away or something. So I'd visit them maybe, once or twice a month and just pester everybody and just have a good time, really.
One of your most famous games for Hewson was obviously Cybernoid. And, around this time, I know Hewson are kind of known for releasing the best quality games. And that kind of really sealed that as well. And it was kind of a bit of a cross between a shooter and a platformer. It was a bit of a strange concept, really, wasn't it? How did that kind of come about then?
Really, it was an extension of Exelon, really, in a way. But instead of just being pretty much a horizontal game, I just added the vertical movement as well. It was the same kind of idea. The fact that it was spaceships was kind of irrelevant. I used to not think about the games in that way. It was I would just think about how things were going to move, and then I would build a story on top of that. So it just happened to end up a spaceship. It could have been anything, a creature or a person flying around or something like that. It's just chance that it happened to end up as a space theme, really.
Well, it was always praised for having great graphics and kind of pushing the specky to its limits, getting the maximum amount of juice you can out of the Spectrum. Did you enjoy that kind of efficiency and getting the code really tight?
Yeah, that was one of the most enjoyable parts of coding, was having this very simple, basic machine and just pushing it to the absolute limits and using all sorts of tricks that you've pinched from other people or discovered and all this kind of thing, and then just really pushing the machine hard. You knew that you pushed it to the absolute maximum. There wasn't anything else you could do with it, It's not like now where, there's a new graphics card coming out, so I don't have to worry about that. The machine you had was the machine you had, and you have to get the absolute best out of it.
Well, it seems you might have been a bit of a cheeky chap back then, because there's often like some stuff in your games. Like, I remember in Stormlord, there was like the naked lady fairies in the background that were censored in the Mega Drive versions, and there was maybe a few other examples in your games of that too.
Yeah, I used to get bored. You know what it's like. You put these things in, and once Hewson asked me to write a press release. I can't remember what it might have been. Exelon, even, or it might have been Exelon. And they didn't read it before they sent it out, and it was it was just full of innuendo, basically. And the magazine received this thing and published it. And there was a few comments about one magazine called it the bizarreness of the waffle. They called it. They couldn't believe that they'd released this.
What was Andrew's reaction to that then?
it wasn't that bad, to be quite honest. It was just a bit strange and funny. So we got away with it that time. He read everything I wrote after that, that's for sure.
Boys will be boys.
yeah, exactly.
I remember one other compilation that Hewson put out, actually. They put out Secco's Collection, and that must have been like one of the first times that a game collection was named after the creator. Was that quite an honour?
It was really strange seeing a box like that with my surname as the kind of in the main title, But it kind of made sense, because Hewson has been very good at the PR with releasing the games and pushing my name along with the games to give a bit of personality to them. So So it certainly made sense to do that at the end. They all credit to Houston. They really knew their stuff in terms of generating interest and a lot of PR, definitely.
Well, they ran into financial difficulties around 1991, and your last game was Stormlord 2. Was it sad ending your relationship with them, and did you enjoy making Stormlord?
I did. It was. I never really had any issues with Houston's at all. They were a great bunch to work with, and it was sad when they had to close down. Well, they did kind of reopen virtually the next day under 21st Century, I think it was at the time, but unfortunately I'd kind of moved on by then, and that's when I went to work at Vivid Image.
Did you never have any plans to, like, did they make no offer for you to come to 21st Century Entertainment then, or was it never on the cards?
No, it didn't pan out like that. And I think they, what was it, pinball games that they started doing or something, which really wasn't my thing. You know, we kind of drifted apart in terms of what we wanted to work on, I think. So I didn't want to work on pinball games. That's why I ended up going elsewhere, I think.
And, of course, that was the period that it was kind of changing to 16-bit. Around then, from 8-bit.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a transitional period at the time, and you know, all the coders were looking towards, you know, the Atari ST and the Amiga and so on. I mean, I did one more Spectrum game at Vivid Image, a game called Time Machine, which was actually a brilliantly designed little game, actually. But after that, it was all 16-bit.
So, how did you join Vivid then? What was the story there?
I don't remember exactly how we met up, to be quite honest, but again, it was a small industry, so coders and publishers and developers, they would invariably meet up at some point if they knew that, you know, you were looking for work or something. So I don't remember exactly how we ended up meeting up, but we did, and we struck up a working relationship.
Well, obviously at Vivid, you got to work with Mev Dink. That must have been quite exciting.
It was. I mean, Mev's a great, obviously I'm working with him again now.
We love Mev.
He's quite a character, Mev, and it's always been a hell of a lot of fun working with him. Loads of ideas, too many ideas sometimes, loads of enthusiasm. Obviously we're working together now, and it's like nothing's changed really. It's the same old people getting excited about things again.
What was kind of the working atmosphere like at Vivid then? Did you guys, like, you know, was it kind of play hard and party hard, or was it long hours? What was it like?
It was always, to be quite honest, there wasn't much partying at Vivid as I can remember, to be quite honest. But, they were working hard. I didn't work in-house. Again, I was freelance, and I'd visit their offices in Harrow, you know, two or three times a month and work there sometimes. But I was mostly at home anyway.
Well, one of your big projects was the legendary First Samurai, and that was on the new Commodore Amiga. What did you think of the machines when you started using them?
It was wonderful. After coming from the Spectrum, which was a great little machine, but to have all that, all the extra colours and the memory and the lovely processor and all that kind of thing, it was a real luxury to be able to program a machine like that. And it was, way, way ahead of its time, the Amiga. Really great machine, and I absolutely loved working on it.
Well, being a Spectrum fan before that, was it a bit of a difficult step using a Commodore machine? That must have felt a bit dirty.
No, I was never very tribal like that. I mean, I really rated the Commodore 64 as well, but my good friend Nick Jones, he used to do all the Commodore 64 conversions of my game, so I never really got the chance to program that machine, but it was a very good machine as well. I'd work on anything, whatever was exciting and new, I was quite happy to work on.
Yeah, it must have been mind-blowing with the palette choices and stuff afterwards.
Oh, yeah, 4,096 colours, if you were clever. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, and we got that lovely gradient sky effect. It's amazing things that you used to be proud of in those days, but it was great, yeah, lovely machine, way ahead of its time.
And obviously around then, the consoles, you know, we had the Super Nintendo and the Sega Mega Drive as well. Did you kind of have an interest in those? Because I know a lot of your games came out on those systems as well. Did you
I personally worked on the Sega Mega Drive. it made sense to do that because it was the same processor as the Amiga, so there wasn't really a learning curve in terms of learning the actual language, as it were. But obviously, the hardware was different. You had all the sprites and fancy sounds and so on. But it was a very nice machine to use. I created Second Samurai on the Mega Drive.
I just really loved First Samurai. I thought it was such a good kind of arcadey title as well. And it was probably the closest thing we had on the Amiga to a proper arcade game, you know?
Yeah, it was, you could probably see the influence from, you know, other games that I'd done in the past, like X-Long. It was, you know, a bit platformy, but there was a lot of different elements in it. You have all the huge levels that you had to explore and bosses, and obviously we went crazy with the sound. This was another thing where I put these samples in just as a joke, if you remember the Hallelujah chorus and all that stuff. Yeah. It just ended up staying in. You didn't worry about things too much in those days. It just stayed in. It was, people would have a bit of a laugh. Although now when I play the videos on YouTube and watch it, I think, oh my God, it's almost unbearable because it keeps doing it. But it was fun at the time, certainly.
The way you move through the levels as well was really interesting. It wasn't just your kind of platformers, you know, there was different bits underneath and on top. It was just a nice way of playing.
Yeah, they were really, really big levels, actually. Possibly even too big. They were really quite sprawling, and you could dig down with your sword and visit all the caverns and things, and you could obviously climb. So you could go absolutely everywhere. And, it would take quite a while to actually finish the levels because they were so big.
Well, you made an interesting point there about the fact that you could kind of sneak these, like, you know, samples in and do that kind of thing. I imagine, you know, in the games industry after that, when we got into like the mid-90s, you started getting these big teams where it'd be like, you know, like 50 people working on a game or even bigger. This must have been kind of like the last era where it was just a couple of guys that you could get a game out with.
Yeah, I think it was obviously have all the little indie studios now that are doing things, you know, with a very small team. So that's kind of come back to a certain extent. But it certainly did stop once you started getting into the kind of the console era and beyond, you know, into the PlayStation and so on. It was completely changed, and it was bigger and bigger teams, and you kind of became a much smaller cog in the whole process of actually making the games.
Yeah, it kind of loses that little personality. It's, you know, these little cheeky pieces that everyone has in their games.
Yeah, it's still try and sneak things in where you can, whatever you can get away with. You have to be very careful with things like copyright and all that kind of thing now. So you don't want to get litigated against, you know, just for stealing a little sample or something like that. So
I think everybody did that in the Amiga. They all stole each other's samples.
Yeah, well, because it could play samples. You had to have samples.
Well, obviously, around that time, one of your most, you know, I'd say polished titles that came out then was the incredible Street Racer, which, you know, we regard as better than Mario Kart. We, you know, we love that game. And the multiplayer elements of that game as well was amazing. What was the development process of that then, and what involvement did you have on that?
Well, to be clear with that, I was actually involved in the design of that game in the initial stages. I drew up all the characters and a lot of the moves and things like that. But it was actually Chris and Tony West who actually programmed that game. And it was Chris West who did all the coding for the four-player split screen. And he did an amazing job because I know the Super Mario Kart was actually using a DSP chip, I think, to actually do that kind of stuff. And we didn't have one. And obviously the publishers were very happy because it meant it was cheaper to manufacture.
Did you get a lot of comparisons against Mario Kart, I imagine, then?
Yeah, I think we did. And I think when Mev was doing the PR for that, they had people at Nintendo gathering around having a look, saying, no extra chips in this cartridge. They were wondering how we did it. So, it was a really, technically, very impressive game.
Well, after this period, obviously you mentioned the PlayStation coming along, and kind of that did change quite a lot. Do you remember the first time you saw PlayStation?
Yes, I think we got the early development kits and we saw some of the demos and things like that. Obviously, everything had gone from 2D to 3D, which was like it was a massive sea change, that much bigger than going from 8-bit to 16-bit, because you had to think about things in completely different ways. And all of a sudden, you know, you had to know a bit more about mathematics and this kind of thing. So yeah, it was incredibly different seeing games presented in a 3D way.
It's a bit strange, isn't it? Because if you look at those early PlayStation games, I think they've actually aged worse than like the Amiga games and the Mega Drive games.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because you kind of had this kind of exponential improvement in the graphics, certainly in 3D, whereas 2D games kind of got to a certain point and they stayed there. But certainly with 3D, you know, every couple of years it was just so much better looking. And it was probably why early 3D games look pretty awful now.
As a developer then, that must have been, you know, you think of that late 80s to kind of mid-90s era, stuff was changing like every 2 years. You got a massive new generational leap, didn't you? Was it hard to keep up with it?
The biggest change was, as I said, was going from 2D to 3D, because that was, everything was alien. You know, it was all trigonometry and matrices and all this kind of mathematics stuff that, you know, you kind of dabbled with it a bit when you were doing 2D games, but 3D, there was no choice. You had to do it. And also creating all the art was completely different. Before, you were just, you know, it was just pixels, but then you were having to model things in triangles and polygons, and it was just completely different.
Those extra dimensions
make it really literally confusing, an extra dimension to development. Yeah, certainly.
Well, you're working with Mev Dink again these days, then, aren't you?
Yes, I am working with Mev Dink again.
Tell us about this then.
Well, we met up about 2.5 years ago when Mev was visiting from abroad, because he'd been in Turkey for years and he'd basically kicked off the games industry there, which is, you know, quite a bustling big industry there now. And he came to London, he was visiting, he said, you know, do you want to meet up? And we just got started talking about remaking First Samurai. It wasn't, the time wasn't right then, because I was working on other things and we just couldn't sort out the timing. But then Mev, he'd been in Barcelona for a while as well, and he came back to London, you know, about 6 months ago, and said, well, I'm back in the UK now, there's no excuses. So we've just basically got together again. We've started a new startup company, Pixel Age Studios, and we're remaking First Samurai. It's going to be called Super Samurai.
What's it like, though, like getting the team back together? That must be amazing.
It's exactly the same, apart from the fact people are kind of heavier and have less hair and things like that. But it's the same. It's incredible, actually. It's just the same enthusiasm, the same arguments and wanting to throttle each other over the most pathetic little things. And yeah, it's exactly the same. It's quite weird. I'm glad that we've all got that energy still. Which is the main thing, and that energy and enthusiasm for creating games again, which is great.
Does people's interest in like your old titles still like amaze you, the fact that people are still talking about work that you did like 20 or 30 years ago?
Yeah, it does. And it's sometimes I almost feel guilty that I'm not as enthusiastic about it as other people are. Because, you know, you kind of move on to other things. But, you know, it's great, and it's incredibly flattering to have people say that, you know, they loved playing your games and it was all part of their childhood. And you think, well, yeah, that's brilliant. That's a very nice thing to hear.
So tell us about the new version of First Samurai then. What can we expect from this then?
It's, oh, well, amazing graphics, of course. There'll be a lot of humour in there, certainly where we can fit it in, because we think things have got far too serious in places. But fantastic music. We've got Alistair Brimble actually doing our music soundtrack for us as well.
Oh, excellent.
Very famous games music composer.
He was our first guest on this podcast 43
really?
Episodes ago, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, he was very enthusiastic as well. And we're just expanding on the original concept, so there's going to be more magic and more different moves and just all the kind of things that we would have wanted to have put in the Amiga version but couldn't do at the time. It's going to look very, very high-end and modern and 3D, of course, but we're still going to try and retain the kind of immediacy and simplicity of the gameplay, certainly in the outset when you start playing the game. But obviously that will develop into a big, sprawling action-adventure. Loads of stuff going in, basically.
You're going to have big bosses in there as well.
Yeah, well, we have to have bosses. There's no escape from the bosses, and they'll certainly be an integral part of the game. definitely.
It's crazy because, you know, you play like First Samurai and stuff again now. And as a kid, like, you know, I could play it no problem. I find it so hard now. It's like whether my reflexes have slowed down or what, I'm not sure.
Oh, it's the same here. I play the odd game on the emulator sometimes, and I just can't play. My reaction times are measured in whole seconds now. So, yeah, I'm not very good at them anymore. I've got a daughter, and she loves games. So I still play things like Gang Beasts and things like that with her. But I wouldn't say I was a hardcore gamer, because I just can't be a hardcore gamer. I just don't have the reaction times now.
It's that level of concentration and focus you need that's really hard.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Stick to making them instead.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the main thing. Yeah, I can play them a bit, so I'm not brilliant. But the main thing is making them and having fun doing it.
Have you had a nice reaction then from people now they hear that First Samurai and Street Racer are coming back then? You must have had some.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really started the main PR push yet. We've got our Kickstarter campaign starting very, very soon, and that's when things will really kick off. Mev's circling the wagons as we speak, getting things ready, and it's going to look great, and we're going to have a great video so people will be able to see some of the things that are going to be in there, and music and all sorts. So, yeah, very exciting.
Well, as soon as that Kickstarter begins, do let us know, and we'll obviously give it a big plug on the show. And
Don't worry, we'll be running after you, telling you about it. Don't worry about that.
We'd love to do a little review as well, and sit down and have a play. I'm sure that'd be fun.
Yeah, any beta copies or anything?
Well, Raf, it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Brilliant. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And I'm glad that, you know, you and Mev are working back together again, and we think it's so cool that we're going to have a chance to play these classic games in a new generation are going to get to experience them as well.
Great. If people want to find out anything more, this is why I get a plug-in. If they visit pixelagestudios.com, there's a couple of links there at the moment going to our social media site, so people can check things out as things develop.
Excellent. We'll put those links in our show notes on our website as well.
Brilliant.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Raf. Been lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much.